That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree, it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today I'm coming to you from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. There are two topics about which one rarely hears anything positive or optimistic these days. One is, lamentably, China, and the other, maybe even more lamentably, the environment. Well, today on Seneca, I am just delighted to be joined by someone who can offer some much-needed and not just wishful, 正能量, positive energy on both of these issues, and together, yet a twofer. Barbara Finnemore is the senior attorney and senior strategic director for Asia of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, who has been at the vanguard in environmental law in China. In 2019, she published an excellent slim volume called Will China Save the Planet? She happens to be in my neighborhood. She was speaking yesterday at the Duke UNC China Leadership Summit this weekend. So I enticed her over to the Seneca South Studio here to chat about what China is doing to kick its coal addiction and to catalyze a renewable energy industry. Barbara, thanks so much for joining me here today and welcome to Seneca.
It's my pleasure.
It's so great to have you here. I mean, the stars finally aligned. I've been meaning to get Barbara on the show for ages. I think anybody listening to this show is probably aware that China is and has for some years been the largest carbon emitter of any country. And they may have even, if they heard the show that I did recently with Alex Wong, they know that even in per capita carbon emissions, it has now surpassed Europe. So listeners are probably also aware that China has come a long way from being regarded as something of a spoiler back, you know, just a little over a decade ago in 2009. At the COP25, I'm sorry, at the, what was it? COP what? I can't remember. I'm just going to say Copenhagen. From being regarded as something of a spoiler just, you know, a little over a decade ago in Copenhagen, to a leader in many regards when it comes to renewables and clean energy. So Barbara, in your talk yesterday, which was just fantastic, you really set the stage with some, I mean, to me, they were just kind of mind-blowing statistics about solar, about wind, about renewables in general, about batteries. If you don't mind, could you go over some of those major markers of progress from the last decade?
I'd be happy to, Kaiser. And as you say, it's true that China is the leading emitter of greenhouse gases. Most of that comes from coal. Even today, as China is working to kick its coal addiction, it is consuming as much coal as the rest of the world put together. However, what people don't realize is that in a little over a decade, China has gone from virtually no renewable energy to becoming the world leader in wind and in solar and in electric vehicles and in battery production. And through its massive economies of scale, as well as its huge domestic markets, which are driving demand, China has played the major role in a dramatic decline in the cost of these clean energy technologies. Solar power has dropped by 90%.
Oh my God, yeah.
In just a little over a decade. And wind power, a more mature technology, has dropped by 50%. And with China's enormous gigafactories for battery production for electric vehicles, the costs of those batteries has dropped by 87%.
Wow.
In one decade. And as a result, China has fundamentally changed the economics of clean energy throughout the world.
Not just in China, but around the world.
Not just in China.
I think you said yesterday something like, I can't remember the percentage, but it was like, was it two-thirds of people live in countries where the cost of renewables is now cheaper than the cost of coal-generated electricity?
That's correct.
It's two-thirds.
It's two-thirds
wow.
of the world population. And we're on an even larger, more significant trajectory where in the next few years, experts predict that it will be cheaper to build new wind and solar plants than to operate existing coal plants and to buy the coal for operating existing coal plants, which can then be shut down and make a profit.
Wow. I mean, that seems like an incredibly significant point. Is there a name for that point? Is it a parity point?
Grid parity.
Grid parity. That's what it is. Grid parity. And we're really there. We're practically there.
Grid parity is where two-thirds of the population is now. But this would be the next stage of the revolution in
wow.
clean energy, where it's cheaper to build new plants than to operate existing ones.
What have been the levels of investment that have made this possible? I mean, how much has China put into this effort to develop its renewable sector?
Over the last 10 years, excluding investment in large hydro, which many people, myself included, do not consider to be a form of renewable energy
right.
because of its environmental impact, China has invested some $756 billion.
My God.
In renewable energy over the last decade, which is more than twice that of the next largest investor, the United States.
Wow. So over 10 years, the U.S. is only $300-some-odd billion
into
renewable. That's phenomenal. A lot of this, I mean, I have to say, I've encountered a lot of my Chinese friends who conflate the idea of air pollution and the idea of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And in China, because of the coal thing, because it's both driven by coal, that makes some sense. I would say, I mean, it's actually kind of a fortuitous thing that people do conflate these things in China, because it seems like that was really something that gave the Chinese leadership a real kick in the pants to get them going. But is there a downside to that conflation? I mean, isn't it possible that if China is successful in reducing air pollution, that attention will come off of the maybe even greater problem, maybe not so short-term, but the greater long-term global problem of greenhouse gas emissions?
You're right. Because coal is the largest source of China's devastating air pollution, as well as its CO2 emissions, it was the air pollution that drove the Chinese government to really begin to tackle its coal consumption for the first time. And that has good and bad impacts. The risk is, number one, is that the air pollution has been of most concern along the eastern coast of China, the most populated cities. Therefore, China's focus on cutting coal consumption has been also focused in those large cities.
Right.
This gives an incentive to China's coal industry to move its operations out to the western part of China, where there are fewer population and therefore less concern about air pollution. That's called pollution leakage.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is that CO2 emissions don't know any boundaries.
Right.
So wherever the coal consumption occurs, that's a real threat to the environment. And also, as you say, if China is successful in reducing its air pollution in its key regions, there is the concern that over time there'll be less of a focus on cutting CO2 emissions. Although I would argue that China recognizes that it is one of the countries that is most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
Right. Wasn't there a recent study that looked at what happens in a bad scenario for Shanghai itself, for the city of Shanghai?
Yes. A recent study estimates that Shanghai might be underwater by 2050. And Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, the Pearl River Delta, those cities are among the top 10 in the world most vulnerable to sea level rise.
So there is a conscientiousness within the leadership, at least, of carbon emissions as a standalone issue, and it's not just air pollution. What about in the broader population, though?
You know, a recent study found that people understand that climate change is happening. Many of them believe that it has affected them personally. They understand that it's primarily caused by human activity. But interestingly enough, most people believe in the government's power and willingness to address the issue. So there is less of an effort or incentive to take personal action, although many people are willing to pay a little bit more for low-carbon products and services.
It's interesting you say that a lot of people in China do believe in the government and its ability to address or its claims about what it's managed to do. You know, we're living in a moment where we're facing a major epidemic, which is centered, of course, in China, in Hubei, in the city of Wuhan. Many people are asking what the role of the Chinese political system has been in helping to both spread the virus, but also to contain it. I think a mutual friend of ours, Joan Kaufman, wrote a really great piece that looked at, you know, how it's both been a tremendous help and a hindrance that China has such an authoritarian system, which I think is a very fair assessment of it. But we might ask a similar question about China's authoritarian politics and their impact on Chinese environmental policy. What's your take on this? Has it been more helpful or has it been harmful?
China's focus on clean energy through its top-down, primarily through its top-down command and control political system has been helpful in some ways and not so much in other ways. And it's not just one these days because there is, like in the U.S., much more focus in key cities at a bottom-up approach to reducing the impacts of climate change, to focusing on developing clean energy technology. Many people believe that, you know, China has an advantage in addressing environment and climate change issues because it can basically wave its magic wand, come up with new policies, which it does on a regular basis, and that immediately they will be enforced and implemented. Well, as we all know, it's the enforcement and the implementation that are a key problem in all Chinese policies. And local governments often feel that they are inundated with policy directives from the center, and they can't comply with all of them. Maybe many of them are unfunded mandates, or they don't believe it's in their own best interest to comply with certain of these mandates. For example, focusing on cutting their coal use. Mm-hmm. Many local governments believe that their economies were built on coal. They provide jobs. They provide tax revenue. So when the government tries to cut back, they often feel, as the old saying goes in China, that the mountain is high and the emperor is far away.
I get that. I mean, and it's also the case that there are perverse incentives, right, that often they're graded, really, local and provincial level officials are sort of evaluated by the organization bureau or the organization department on basically the crude metric of GDP growth, job creation, and things like that. Is the mentality changing in that regard? Are they trying to create – you know, more comprehensive evaluative criteria that embrace green GDP and things like that?
The rating system is changing, both by the central government, which is trying to give equal focus on environmental protection as well as economic growth. Some provinces are going even further than the central government and putting environmental indicators above economic ones. And others, such as Shanghai, have abandoned economic targets altogether. However, the mentality dies hard.
Yeah.
And local governments in many places, not all, but many places, continue to believe that their path to promotion and career success is to continue growing their local GDP.
So we've been talking about some of these, you know, reasonably enlightened policies, but even to get to the point where they would, you know, want to be implementing and executing on such policies, a lot had to change. I think we can all think back not too very long ago to a time, you know, when the negotiations for the framework agreement back in the early 90s, you know, and all the way up through Copenhagen in 2009, this Chinese attitude that was always being brought up, that China should be treated differently because it's a developing country, that, you know, look at you, developed Western countries, you've been pigging out at the hydrocarbon trough for 150 years, and now it's our turn at the trough. That has fallen away. I'm really curious, like, what were the drivers that made Chinese leaders really change their minds on this? I mean, I think we all can think of, you know, there's public opinion and things like that, but there were also some, like, I feel like there were some key turning points. 2004, for example, the big energy shortfalls that happened. Was that 2004 or 3?
2004.
Right, right. What were some of the inflection points for you, and what were some of the big drivers for this changing mindset and the leadership?
When I first started working in China for NRDC, when I started our China program, one of the first things we focused on was energy efficiency, that there was so much opportunity for China to use less coal simply by becoming more productive and efficient in how it uses that coal. But when we started that work, China was just not interested. It was still focused on electrifying the country, building as many new coal-fired plants as possible to fuel its economic miracle. And in that decade of the 2000s, after China joined the WTO, it tripled its coal consumption to power that economic miracle. It quadrupled its GDP. It quintupled its exports, all focused on coal. But it simply couldn't build new coal plants fast enough. So around 2004 is when the country began to experience widespread power shortages and had to close plants down put them on midnight shifts. This was a huge blow to the economy. And that's when they came back to us and said, now, let's talk about energy efficiency.
So that was the word they used, all the carbon intensity was, I guess they weren't even talking yet about carbon intensity, just energy efficiency, yeah, back then.
Energy intensity was the first time they addressed this issue in the five-year plan.
And the NRDC started working on this, right, just how to make your factories, I think one of the big initiatives that you guys were working on was green buildings, right?
That's right.
What kind of an impact does that have? I mean, give us a sense. I read it in your book, and I was pretty flabbergasted. I know that, you know, insulating your house is important, but these large office buildings, wow, a huge impact, right?
Huge impact, because China is the world's largest construction site, and building energy use is probably its fastest growing source of CO2 emissions, just as China's rapid urbanization continues. There are both the challenges of reducing emissions, but also enormous opportunities for real low-cost, no-cost measures of reducing emissions from buildings. And from a very small start, when we helped to manage the very first internationally certified green building in China, to the situation we're in today, where China's current five-year plan calls for 50% of all new buildings to meet its own green building rating system, and enormous retrofit programs throughout the country.
That's one of the things. So the 2004 energy crunch that happened. The other, I think, that everyone is aware of is the apocalypse. And it was actually, I was talking with Deb Seligson the other day online. We were trying to remember, when was that word first used? Because, I mean, crazy bad was used, I think, I think she said it was 2011, 2012. And I think we decided that apocalypse was 12-13 that winter.
I think that's right.
Okay. So what was the impact of Air Apocalypse? And also, what was the impact of the U.S. Embassy and its, I mean, this is in the age of Twitter, right? So they started to tweet out the daily, or not daily, just hourly PM2.5 numbers. And then this was something that all of us who were living in China at the time were just glued to. I mean, we all could sort of tell you hour by hour what in Beijing the PM2.5 readings were. But this wasn't just among, you know, the costed expats there. There was also really important people in China who were alive to this. And I'm curious what kind of an impact they had.
There are two things going on. One is that air pollution, which had been building steadily for years, did get tremendously worse during that 2012-2013 winter, to the extent that it was like as if living in Beijing was living in an airport smoking lounge.
that's true.
And I mean, hospital emissions were soaring. And one study found that it was as if every man, woman, and child was smoking 1.5 cigarettes every hour.
Wow.
Enormous. So people could see it. But for many years, people, I would go there and say, boy, wow, this air pollution. They'd say, yes, it's a foggy day. People
right.
didn't know. They didn't have the data they needed to evaluate this smog and the impacts on their health. And so I do believe that when the U.S. Embassy put an air quality monitor on the roof of the embassy, mainly to provide information to the community in the embassy community, it was a turning point.
Mm.
But even more so when Pan Qiri started retweeting those hourly readings on his own website, and it became available
yeah.
to everybody, citizens. And that, I think, was a true turning point, because public concern rose so fast that by the end of that year, the government had enacted a multi-billion dollar air pollution control action plan focused on the key polluted regions on the East Coast.
Let's talk about that action plan. It was the 2013, September of that year, Air Pollution Prevention and Control Action Plan. What did that actually do? Did it have teeth? How effective was it?
It did have teeth. It set targets for 4 years, the end of 2017, for Beijing and Pearl River Delta, Yangtze River Delta, and that was later expanded to other provinces and regions, limits on not only certain types of pollutants, that PM2.5, small particulate matter pollutant, that most Chinese know that term, but also on limits on coal consumption for the first time. That is unheard of,
yeah.
really, to that date. And the government really worked hard to make sure those targets were met. And that's when actually NRDC saw an opportunity here. And we teamed up with 19 Chinese research institutes, academic institutions, and even industry associations, and together put together a China coal consumption cap program.
Wow.
And so what we did was issue a series of reports that analyzed what would a mandatory national cap on coal consumption look like? What's the level it should be set at? How should it be allocated to provinces and to sectors? And this was really important because, as I said before, with a national coal cap, you don't have that pollution leakage.
Right.
It's everywhere across
right,
the country.
Right.
And that was enacted in the current five-year plan.
Give me a sense of the scale of the leakage we were talking about. You know, I know, for example, having lived in Beijing, that all they did for a while was just move stuff out to Hebei. But we were sort of in the same airshed anyway, so that didn't really help. And then so they started moving stuff slightly further afield. Still, though, there was leakage everywhere. It didn't seem like the total level of pollutants was maybe in the Beijing airshed, it was declining, but not nationwide. How bad of a problem was leakage?
We still don't know the extent of that leakage, in part because one response of China's coal industry was to look for new technologies, new ways to use coal, and to produce things like chemicals. And they have proposed a series of major coal conversion, coal gasification, coal to chemicals projects out in Western China. And we don't know, the government hasn't really come up with a clear policy as to how many of those programs will be approved or not.
Coal gasification is something you hear an awful lot about, and you address that in your book. Why is that so problematic? What does it do?
It's problematic because the CO2 emissions from this whole process is much, much higher than emissions, CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants, for example, even though they have more opportunities, technologies to capture conventional pollutants. That's the big problem.
So, yeah, this is sort of like, yeah, a typical kind of thing when the downside of conflating air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions is you end up with coal gasification projects that are only addressing one of these issues and not the other. There was another important piece of legislation. You're a lawyer, you're a litigator by training, and the NRDC worked to train a lot of civil society organizations in China, NGOs, after the passage of this 2015, I think it was. It was in 2015, the Environmental Protection Law, which allowed NGOs then to sue polluters. Can you talk about those training programs and some of the cases that you guys were involved in? And there's one I remember that you wrote about in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
NGOs had long had the ability to bring lawsuits in China against polluters. But what the amendments of 2015 to China's bedrock environmental law did was to set up a comprehensive system designed to assist NGOs in overcoming the obstacles they were facing to bringing this type of litigation. And as a litigator, it just amazed me at how much they did in the law and in the accompanying guidelines to help these NGOs who struggle and continue to struggle with lack of resources, lack of training, lack of access to data. And what we did for many, many years was hands-on training of hundreds of, even maybe thousands of NGO representatives, of lawyers, of judges, of members of the environmental protection establishment, and try to show them how this system could work, and to help them participate more actively in litigation, but also in environmental decision-making, in Freedom of Information Act requests, China's equivalent of that. And there have emerged some, just a handful, unfortunately, but some very, very effective Chinese NGOs who now bring these lawsuits on a regular basis. And one of my favorite cases is still ongoing now, but two of these Chinese NGOs have brought lawsuits in Western China against the utility company, saying they are not complying with China's renewable energy law, first issued in 2005, which from the beginning required utility companies to purchase all of the renewable energy that was generated within their service territory. That has been largely honored in the breach, but these NGOs are bringing suit and looking for compensation for the renewable energy companies for their failure to comply.
So the NGOs are able to sue on behalf of, for example, a plaintiff like a renewable energies company, but it can also bring sort of public interest lawsuits, right?
Public interest. That's the system in the law, environmental public interest lawsuits. And unlike the U.S., where you groups like mine have to prove standing, have to prove injury to our members to bring suit, once a Chinese NGO is qualified and meets certain criteria and is qualified to bring these lawsuits, they can bring them anywhere in the country.
Wow.
And that's what we're seeing here.
So that leads me to another question, which is, I got to think that there are a lot of unsung heroes in this story, a lot of people who played important roles in passing some of this legislation, who are heading some of these, you know, spearheading some of these projects at NGOs themselves. I think a lot of people are familiar with some of the environmental activists like Ma Jun, for example. A lot of people maybe know some of the more high-profile lawyers who've brought environmental lawsuits like Zhang Jingjing and people like that. Who are some of the other big unsung heroes? I got to believe that there are some even in the environmental ministry and in the, not the NRDC, but the NDRC or... who are some that you would single out?
Well, I have to give a shout out to Wang Sanfa, one of China's leading litigators. In fact, my first project in China back in 1992, when he was a professor at the China University of Politics and Law, he and I were asked to give the very first training program in China on environmental law for judges, environmental protection officials, and NGOs. And I remember him asking me, what happens in the United States when you've got environmental protests? How does the U.S. handle that? And I said, well, they do give the public, you know, the ability to bring these lawsuits and develop Chinese NGOs. And next thing I know, he had founded, you know, the first Chinese NGO designed to do these, bring these lawsuits. And he's been very, very successful. So I think he's an inspiration to many in China. But like you say, there are people, many people within the government who have also played a path-breaking role, who have worked tirelessly to promote a clean environment and low-carbon development. One of them would be Pan Yue. Mm-hmm. Pan Yue, who was deputy director of the China's Environmental Protection Agency, SEPA, at the time, for many years. And he pioneered the idea of green GDP. So when China has been focused on meeting GDP targets every year, he said, well, let's redefine what GDP means so that you're not only looking at economic growth, but you take into account the offsetting use of resources, depletion of resources, and environmental degradation to come up with a real balanced view of whether or not you're promoting a green GDP.
That is a major contribution, yeah.
Yeah. And Xie Jianhua, who also headed the SEPA for a number of years, but then was China's lead climate negotiator from Copenhagen until just recently. I do believe that he played a very valuable role in the series of bilateral agreements signed by the U.S. and China that paved the way for the Paris Agreement.
Mm.
It provided that necessary momentum, action by the world's two largest emitters.
Because he was sort of cast in a black hat role at Copenhagen itself. I think there were a lot of people who were very critical of him. But although privately people told me, no, they think he's actually on the side of good. I guess he redeemed himself in the years between.
He has redeemed himself.
Yeah, that's great. Barbara, a lot of your book focuses on China's efforts, of course, to dethrone King Coal, as you refer to it. Maybe give us a sense of just how big China's coal addiction was. I know we've talked about it a little bit, but are there numbers that we can sort of handily draw on? What was coal in the energy mix 20 years ago? Where is coal in the energy mix today? How many gigawatts of coal-fired power plants are there in China? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, 20 years ago, I believe that coal was something like 70% of China's energy mix and about 80% of its power generation.
Hmm.
There wasn't much else
right.
at the time.
A lot of the rest was hydro, too, which
a
is
lot
not,
of the
not
rest
problematic
was
in
hydro.
Some way. Yeah.
Today, this mandatory national cap on coal consumption sets a target of 58% of China's energy mix being coal by the end of this year, by 2020. China's mm-hmm. already surpassed that. We're about at 56% now.
Great.
That's a huge decrease.
Yeah.
But we think China can go a lot further. And in the 14th five-year plan, which is coming up soon, we think China can even go below 50%.
So talk about this China Coal Consumption Cap Plan and Policy Research Project. What does that call on? I mean, so besides putting just simply a cap in place, in order to implement that, what policies does it actually do? How does it make that a reality?
What we're doing now is working with local governments in four key provinces to actually help them implement the coal cap that's been allocated to them. And that's not so easy.
No, I can't imagine.
I mean, some provinces, like Shandong province, consumes twice as much coal as Germany.
My God.
These are enormous, enormous. China produces, a lot of it is not just coal-fired power plants, but coal that is burned directly in iron, steel, and cement plants, heavy industry. Again, a lot of the opportunity there to reduce coal emissions is by making those factories more efficient. But there's a bigger issue here, and that is jobs.
Right.
The transition for these heavily coal-dependent provinces to clean energy and to other forms of employment for their population. This is something we saw the UK, we saw Germany deal with over many years. China's dealing. We're dealing with it here in the US. So that's what we're doing now. We came up recently with a 60-page report on that very sort of just transition for the workers in the coal industry and smokestack industries. And we're working on the ground. That's the only way to really ensure full implementation.
And it's great that, I mean, it's, again, one of the important messages that you take away from the book is that it is possible to catalyze a new energy economy. And this is one of those rare areas where you see kind of a overlap between Xi Jinping and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. There's a lot of thinking in this that is definitely redolent of the Green New Deal, this idea that building the transitioning to a green economy will be job creating, will be growth generating. There's going to be a lot of people, especially on the American right, who are just very critical of that idea, who are very skeptical of that idea. What is your argument for why you think that will actually happen? Are there countries that you can point to where that has happened, for example?
I can point to China. China is the leader in green jobs, clean energy jobs. Of the 11 million green jobs worldwide, China has 4 million.
Oh, wow.
There's more jobs in clean energy in China than in the coal mining industry. So they have done it. They get it. And they've shown how it could be done.
Isn't it true that even here in the United States, so many people who work in the power industry are already involved? I mean, that, you know, a significant portion of their hours are spent in renewables, in solar installations, in wind installations, and things like that. You had some stats in there about that, right?
Yes. In the United States, until recently, when Trump instituted tariffs on the solar, foreign solar panels, the leading, fastest growing job category in the United States was solar panel installer.
Wow.
And the second fastest growing job category was wind turbine installer. These are huge job categories in the United States: installation, maintenance, sales, not necessarily production, because for solar in particular, the manufacturing process is largely automated.
Right,
but
right.
In the service sector, this is enormous.
Wow. Yeah, I think there's really, really good reason to believe this. And I think it's important that we start looking more seriously at Green New Deal and things like it. Let's talk about the problem. I mean, some of the stubborn problems that still persist. Renewable energy is great and everything, but it tends to get kicked off the grid before coal-fired power plants. And this is not just a problem in China, but also elsewhere. In Germany, it's a problem where, you know, the renewables are probably the highest in any major economy's energy mix. What is this problem, of curtailment, and what is actually being done to address it? Can you explain it to people who maybe aren't as familiar?
Even though China leads the world in solar and wind capacity. That's how much is available on the ground. I mean, one out of every three solar panels in the world is in China. One out of every three wind turbines in the world is in China. But until fairly recently, much of that energy generated by wind and solar never made it into the grid for a variety of reasons. It's really a complex mix of geographical issues, technological issues, and political issues. I'll start with the political ones. I think the main challenge has been the way the rules of the grid have been designed. Mm-hmm. They were designed, you know, 20 years ago or more, specifically to accelerate the construction of new coal-fired power plants as far as possible. So basically, every coal plant that was built, regardless of whether it was needed or how cheap it was relative to other forms of energy, was guaranteed a certain number of hours of operation, was guaranteed a certain price. So building new coal plants was virtually risk-free.
Right.
And even as the cost of solar and wind continued to drop, as long as these rules were in place, they couldn't compete with the coal plants, who would have year-long contracts with those certain fixed operating hours. That's a big problem. Another political problem is, again, local governments want to promote jobs in their own province or cities. Mm-hmm. They don't want to buy necessarily renewable that is generated out in the northwest part of China. So, which, by the way, is where most of the wind and onshore wind and solar have been generated. That's just where the resources are for the most part, for these large utility scale projects, not the solar power that's on your house.
Right. So this is these are political issues. There's technological issues too, like storage, right?
That's the biggest one. What do you do when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining? So every country in the world, or many countries in the world, are now racing to develop new technologies for storing that power for hours or days or perhaps ultimately weeks, so that they can really integrate all of the wind and solar that's being generated onto the grid.
How far are we along with that? I mean, how is there a 10 years from now, are we all going to have, I mean, are there going to be massive battery facilities that are there to store surface power that's generated when the wind is blowing, when the sun's shining?
Well, I think we still, we're making progress, but there still need to be technological breakthroughs that will make energy storage cheap enough to become widespread, like with wind and solar, and also to be more environmentally sensitive.
Right.
And China is acting really fast, trying to develop that focus in the 14th Five-Year Plan. We already know is going to be energy storage, setting targets for higher quality, for lower price, for less of a environmental footprint. So let's see how that goes forward. But we still have a ways to go.
You also mentioned geographic factors, and we've already touched on the fact that the power generation is taking place in the Northwest. You've talked about the political obstacle of them not wanting to buy power. But even if they did want to buy it, isn't there a transmission issue?
Yes. So China has, the state grid company, the world's largest utility, has been pushing for the development of a national network, ultimately international network, of ultra-high voltage transmission lines. They have done, you know, large percentage, built those lines already, including one that goes all the way from western China to Anhui province.
Wow.
That's the world's largest. But there are some technological issues here that still need to be worked out for using those ultra-high voltage transmission lines to transport renewable energy, not just more coal.
Right.
But there's also economic problems. These are not, you know, cheap. That's why they haven't been built in some places already. So given China's economic slowdown, we're also seeing a slowdown in the development of these ultra-high voltage transmission lines. But on the other hand, that gives an opportunity for China to promote more distributed what we call distributed renewable energy, whether it be rooftop solar or community systems that are built where the demand is, where the people are. China's been slow. It's not so easy to really promote these community or individual residential and commercial systems as it is to build huge hardware, out in Western China. But they have upped their targets for distributed energy, and I think that is part of the solution going forward.
Definitely part of the solution. But another part of it is, as you said, China's population is all on the eastern coast. What's off the coast but empty ocean, right? And so there's a lot now. I think China is leading in offshore wind. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, not quite. The UK has recognized the opportunities from offshore wind, and they are still number one. But
okay,
just in the past couple of years, China has caught on and is developing very fast, just like it did with onshore wind and solar. Investing enormous sums of money, more than anybody else in 2018, in developing the technology, hoping to bring down the cost, as it did with wind and solar, training, massive capacity building, and they have targets for offshore wind, and just like anything else, gives certainty to investors,
right,
that if they put their money in this, it's going to be repaid.
That's terrific. Let's turn now to new energy vehicles and what China has been doing to promote the adoption of zero emissions vehicles. What are the big things, in particular, that the U.S. Might learn from the Chinese example,
or
from other examples? I mean, other countries that have successfully used really pretty generous subsidy programs. Like, I think Norway is a country that's done really well in that regard. Yeah.
Yes, Norway is the leader in terms of the percentage of its vehicles that are electric, but the absolute number, of course, is much smaller than in China. And again, I have to give a shout out to one particular person, Wang Gan is his name, who I met back in 2000 when he was an automotive engineer just returning from Germany, where he worked for Audi, and he had a vision of how China could leapfrog the internal combustion engine and go directly to what they call new energy vehicles, hybrids, fuel cell vehicles, all electric. And really single-handedly, he pushed through this program that you're referring to, which includes, and again, interestingly enough, it really began to take off in 2013, the year of the airpocalypse. That's when China's instituted a very generous program of subsidies for owners of electric vehicles, as well as requirements for the government procurement of vehicles and incentives for purchasers. For example, they wouldn't have to wait for a license plate,
right,
or enter a lottery system, and so forth. And in that short period of time, less than a decade, China has invested some $60 billion U.S. in electric vehicle development. That's 10 times as much as we have here in the U.S. And they've set strong policies for fuel emissions from internal combustion engine vehicles, and required automakers to meet small but growing quotas of their fleet to be these new energy vehicles.
Causes some real anxiety with the automakers. They were all scrambling to partner with Chinese partners who had the capacity to make electric vehicles. Yeah.
If you add together all the pledges now that global automakers have made following that new regulation, it's some $300 billion over 5 years in new energy factories, in developing new models and makes of new energy vehicles. It's really remarkable.
And the really ambitious goal is to ban the sale of internal combustion engine vehicles by, 2050, right? Or 20...
Not yet, but China's on its way to considering a total ban on internal combustion engine vehicles. Hainan Province has announced that by 2030, they will have no more such vehicles. China has, some cities already, like Shenzhen, have already transformed their entire taxi fleet and bus fleet to electric vehicles. China is responsible for 99% of the world's electric buses.
Wow.
And this is something we can learn from China in the U.S., is that China has, last May, required every major city if they're not already flipping over their taxi fleet and bus fleet to electric, to come up with a, submit a plan for how they're going to do so. It makes every sense in the world, especially as the price of these clean technologies continues to drop.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're actually in a position right now where they're starting to cut back on subsidies, and demand hasn't been damaged too badly.
That's the remarkable part, because as I said earlier, the prices dropped so much that China is starting to recognize that it doesn't really need the subsidies anymore. And in fact, it can't afford them. It gave so much subsidies to wind and solar that so many new plants were built that it had something like a $17 billion deficit in its renewable energy fund. So it is slashing the subsidies for solar, for wind, and for electric vehicles, and leading to, you know, concern that these technologies would be completely wiped out. Well, they haven't. Interestingly enough, for electric vehicles last year, 2019, sales did drop by 4%, and that's unusual after doubling every year for 5 years.
Right.
However, that's much less than the drop in the sales of the dirty gasoline
right.
and diesel.
Right. This isn't about electric vehicles. This is about vehicle sales is dropping. It's about
8%
slowing.
And a much bigger base.
Right.
And
right.
Some people think that the internal engine in combustion engine in China may already have peaked.
Wow. Let's hope so. I think listeners are probably almost getting optimism overload at this point. So maybe let's turn this to a couple of issues that I think maybe give us some cause for pause. One of them is, you know, after years of people feeling pretty optimistic about this shift toward more renewables and deceleration of the increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Very recently, we've seen a lot of reports in Financial Times and elsewhere about increases, actually, in approvals of coal-fired power plants, actually increases in coal consumption. I think it's still gone up by 200%. And still, you know, we really, you know, if you look at, in spite of all the wonders of renewables, it's still a tiny percentage of the energy mix. It's what, 2% for solar?
3% for solar.
3% for solar. 5%
for wind.
Add that
4% for electric vehicles. Still tiny percentage.
Nuclear is what, another?
4% for nuclear. Still tiny, tiny slices of the big picture.
But let's first talk about this issue of these new approvals of coal-fired plants. What's driving that? How is that being allowed to happen?
Yes. Yeah, so following the Airpocalypse and this Air Pollution Control Action Plan, we saw in 2014 a plateauing of China's coal consumption, which was remarkable. And then it continued to drop for two more years, which meant that China's CO2 emissions dropped for the first time in forever, and also global CO2 emissions dropped, even as the global economy continued to grow. However, starting in 2017, we've seen China's coal use starting to creep up again. Interestingly enough, one main cause of this was a government decision in 2014 to delegate approval authority for new coal-fired power plants to local governments.
Those damn local governments.
In an effort to streamline the bureaucracy, but it backfired. Because as I said before, local governments saw this as an enormous opportunity to approve as many new coal plants as possible. And the central government realized this, tried to put the brakes on it, but were not completely...
Implemented this red light, green light system.
Yes, they set up, among other things, a traffic light system where they allocated every province a color: red, no more coal plant construction; yellow, maybe a few; green, go ahead. We later learned through satellite data that many local governments were just continuing.
Just running the red lights.
Running the red lights. But then with the economic slowdown occurring, China has eased up on that traffic light system, and they have allowed some of this construction to proceed, and they have, in many respects, used tools to stimulate the economy in ways that perpetuate the growth of these smokestack industries. That's what we're seeing now.
You said earlier that carbon doesn't respect provincial boundaries, nor does it respect international boundaries. And China is actually funding something like, what is it? It's a significant percentage of all the coal-fired plants being built in the world right now. Belt and Road projects, which are supposed to be, you know, tilting greener, have not in fact been that way at all. A lot of investments that China is making in Belt and Road recipient countries has actually gone to coal plants. I think it was like, what did you say? It was like
one quarter
of all the coal plants in the world are financed in some way by China. Is Beijing alive to this problem? Are they aware of it? And are there efforts to curb this?
I think the government is well aware of this. China, Japan, and South Korea are the three largest funders of coal-fired power plants throughout the world. And this comes at a time when more and more global and national financial institutions are deciding that they do not want to finance coal fossil fuel plants anymore. That's too much of a risky investment. Many of these plants will never return on their investment. They'll be what we call stranded assets. They're bad investments. But China's view is that the Belt and Road Initiative is really privately run by state-owned, not completely private, they're state-owned enterprises, private companies, and they claim that they're, you know, agnostic, fuel agnostic to just providing what developing countries need. But really what they need is smart investment in low carbon infrastructure.
Right.
And that's, even though China is also the world's largest financier of clean energy, most of that investment goes to countries in the developed world that already have the systems, the policies, the infrastructure in place to accept renewable energy. So there's a big disconnect here.
Right. And in fact, recipient countries can be doing a lot more to demand that Chinese investments in energy infrastructure be cleaner, yeah?
Yes. And what my former colleague Michael Davidson is arguing in a new piece in Foreign Affairs is that really there's enormous opportunity for developed countries to partner with China to help these Belt and Road recipient countries develop the policies and the infrastructure that's necessary to accept this renewable and the financing that's really needed to keep us within our Paris Agreement limits.
So there's still a lot of work to be done and a lot of obstacles remain. What are a couple of things that worry you most in the short and medium term? What do you think might derail all this progress that we've seen?
Right. Well, the coronavirus is a big concern for many, many reasons, most important people's health. We're seeing some articles saying that, well, China's CO2 emissions are dropping because factories are shut. Mm-hmm. What concerns me, in addition to the health impacts, is that once this virus plays out, what is the government going to do to jumpstart the economy again?
Pent up kind of demand.
Are they going to, again, focus on stimulating infrastructure growth, which then leads to more iron, steel, and cement production and will send the emissions and the pollution soaring again? Or will they see this as an opportunity to truly make the transition to the new normal of higher quality but slower economic growth? That's the big question. The other question is, what is China going to include in the 14th five-year plan? Mm. That's going to be absolutely essential. We're making proposals and others as well for a plan that will result in, you know, accelerated retirement of the dirtiest, oldest, most polluting plants, no new net fossil fuel investments, a reduction in fossil fuel consumption by 2030. Or we think a new report we just came out with says that China can peak its oil consumption by 2025.
Wow.
And coal consumption even earlier, because the trouble is they've built so many new coal-fired power plants here. It's just a situation of major overcapacity.
Right.
You know, 40% of China's coal plants are operating at a loss. That's going to head up to 95%. It's in China's best interest economically to avoid building these, black elephants.
Right.
And pre-stranded assets, as Amory Lovins likes to say.
One more thing. Pre-stranded, that's good.
One more thing, it's so important, is every country in the Paris Agreement committed to increase the ambition of its pledges.
The ratchet, yeah.
By the end of this year. So what is China going to do? What is the U.S. going to do? We already know that if Trump is reelected, he's going to withdraw.
Right on the election,
the day after the election.
Right.
If there's a new president, every Democratic candidate has pledged to rejoin the Paris Agreement. So what's going to happen in our election is of paramount concern.
Absolutely.
A concern to me. But what is China going to do? Will it, in fact, increase the ambition of its pledges in a way that we think it can do? Many Chinese experts are saying that China can and do more, including non-CO2 greenhouse gases in its pledge, including specific targets for coal consumption and so forth. So this is a very important year.
Yeah, and the years to come too, irrespective of who wins the White House, I feel like U.S.-China cooperation is absolutely vital. I mean, these are obviously the two leading carbon emitters, but I feel like our insistence on framing everything through this sort of national security lens and the resulting arms race. I saw a statistic not too long ago about the percentage of carbon in the U.S. emitted by defense-related industries, and it's enormous. I've got to think that it's the same for China. And how could this possibly benefit us? If for no other reason, my feeling is that we need to be able, even if we compete, we need to be able to collaborate on this one issue at least.
We absolutely do. And the fact of the matter is it's in both countries' self-interest to cooperate. And I've been delighted to see that one program instituted by the Obama administration for U.S.-China cooperation on clean energy is in fact continuing, and that is the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center, CERC. This involves cooperation between researchers, scientists, companies in both countries on building energy efficiency. NRDC is a part of that one, on electric vehicles, on carbon capture and sequestration. And interestingly enough, the U.S. Congress has reauthorized this program for another 5 years because they see that it's in the U.S. best interest to help develop the kind of innovation that both countries need and the world needs.
Well, that is a good, another optimistic note to end on. It'd be terrific if we can see CERC continue. So thank you so much, Barbara. It was just, what a terrific opportunity. I'm so glad that you were down here in North Carolina and that we had the chance to chat today. So thank you so much. Let's move on to recommendations. But first, let me remind listeners very quickly that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter, which is just chock full of great reads all about China, the latest on the coronavirus and everything else. It's all delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy and Lucas and Jiayun work really, really hard to bring you this product. It is terrific value for money, so sign up and please spread the word. Okay, on to recommendations. Barbara, what do you got for us? Anything fun that you've read recently that you like?
I have to recommend China Dialogue,
online
newsletter that's been about 15 years, based in London.
Isabel Hilton.
Maybe you've had her on your program.
Yeah, she's
but a wonderful, Sam Gill, a wonderful group of writers that really focus week by week on the key issues of environmental sustainability. And their goal is to try to increase understanding of what's going on in China, what the challenges are, what the progress is. And that's certainly something we need a lot more of now.
Absolutely. And it's a bilingual
site.
It's one of the few sites that's like bilingual top to bottom. It's really great. They've just, yeah, they've done terrific work. A lot of the alumni from that have just gone on to do really great things too. I totally, heartily re-endorse that. I mean, that's a fantastic site. And the source of half of what I know about China's environment, at least. I'm going to recommend something that was recommended by Jeff Prescott, when he was on the show just a few weeks ago, the time that we're taping now. He recommended a book that I had been meaning to read for a very long time, which is Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, which is just the definitive book about the Great Migration. It spans, you know, a big swath of the 20th century. And it's just, it had been recommended to me by so many people, and the expectations that I had set for it were so high that I didn't think it could possibly measure up. But it surpasses. The writing is exquisite, and it's an amazing book. I've been casting around looking for has somebody written a book about China's Great Migration, about what's happened, you know, how we have seen, you know, 700 million people move out of the countryside into the cities and, you know, tells the story in a similar way. I mean, I think that I've seen some, there have been some, I think Leslie Chang's book Factory Girls does a really good job on that. There are others like that. But something with that sweeping grand narrative over time, I would just love to see such a book written for China.
Absolutely.
So listeners, if you have recommendations about such books, please let me know. I would love to hear from you. And yeah, you can reach us at Seneca@subchina.com. Barbara, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm feeling super energized by our conversation. The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo, that's me, and Jeremy Goldhorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at Seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts, especially the new excellent China in Africa podcast with Eric Olander and Kobus von Staden. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows coming soon. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.